We apologize for this brief interruption in the show. As many of you likely know, the Higher Standard Podcast is officially sponsored by Transcend Company. Transcend has been my longtime provider for both testosterone and peptide therapies. But they offer so much more. Whether you're interested in health, wellness, or longevity, it all begins with you getting your blood work done. A lab draw will help you get the numbers and establish your baseline. You can go to transcendcompany.com/THSP. That's transcendcompany.com/THSP. Or you can click the link in the show notes on any streaming platform and on YouTube. Fill out your information and one of the representatives will contact you to get your journey started today. Now back to the show.
You just said before the show.
Was that Kendrick Lamar?
Yes. You just told me before the show you don't like Kendrick Lamar.
I know, but you mentioned him before the show. So I started thinking about him. So I started singing. You know, his thing. I'm telling you, man, I'm a big Killer Mike guy right now.
You are.
But Killer Mike's too hard for me to listen to in public.
He is very hardcore.
He's very hardcore. And like, you know, he actually lived that life. And
believer of the Second Amendment?
Yes, he is. Yeah, clearly.
Very strong believer.
Yeah, his arrest speaks to that belief.
It does. So welcome back to the show, everybody. Today we got a very interesting topic that I think can go several different ways, but we are excited to bring it to you. There are four main paths to becoming a millionaire or becoming wealthy over your lifetime. We are going to give you a deep dive into how.
So for context, this actually came from an article that I read in 2019. Mm-hmm. The concept stuck with me for some time, and I want to credit the author because this is actually somewhat of a short version of his longer book. So these are from the book Rich Habits, okay? And it's a study Tom Corley, I think is whatever it is. Yeah.
Here you go. He's got, he pulled
Tom
it up
Corley. Already. Is that it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yep. Okay, great. So I read this on CNBC Make It back in 2019, and it stuck with me as it just rang super true. And what he went into this book doing is studying the habits of millionaires. And coming out of this study and this book, he really narrowed it down to four unique paths that people take to become millionaires, in most cases, without recognizing or appreciating that they're down one of these paths. It's just who they are. It's almost like a personality quirk.
Yeah, that's exactly the point that I was going to make right now is, you know, you could do a self-assessment of yourself and try to figure out which one of these four you are more likely to be and really focus in and hone in on one of these paths.
So we are going to put the article in the show notes, but I am going to quote some of the paragraphs because I think it's really important for context, particularly the percentage of the population that's in each one of these subsets.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so subset number one, the saver's path. So just less than 22% of millionaires in the study chose to take the saver slash investor path. Mm-hmm. Not only is this the easiest way to build wealth, but if you start early, it almost always guarantees a lot of money. The savers investors in the group reach their first $1 million around their mid to late 30s and accumulated an average net worth of $3.3 million by their mid 50s.
Now, in order to be able to do that, they would have had to start really early. You know, this really reminds me of a viral TikTok that I saw.
With your face on it and I think a $100 bill behind it, was it?
And I think it said the caption read $1 million guaranteed. So if you remember what that TikTok said, if you started investing $166 a month, basically $2,000 a year, from between 19 to 28, by the time you are 65, that money right there will have made you $1 million in your lifetime. Had you waited to start investing until after 28 and you kept investing that $2,000 for the next 38 years, you would still come out with $800,000. That's $200,000 less. All that really is trying to paint out is the earlier you start, the better.
Yeah. And I should point out, 1.5 million views, and I did a lot of defending you to a bunch of morons on that post.
Yeah, yeah.
For friend purposes, like, I should get a little bit of credit.
You do, yeah. Okay, yeah,
that's
yeah.
All I'm saying.
I do appreciate that. And for that path right there, look, it's guaranteed success, but what does it take to get there? It requires long-term commitment, right, and a lot of discipline.
So let's talk about what that looks like. There's actually four distinct kind of things that this saver/investor path really came down to. It sounds easy. It sounds like just saving. it's a lot more complex, kind of like what Said alluded to with discipline. Number one, they typically had middle-class income. Many reached a six-figure salary earlier in their careers, and if they didn't, they lived very, very frugally. And the reason why they lived frugally is so they could save more money. They had a low cost of living and preferred to save rather than spend lavishly, so they weren't wearing the Travis Scott Lowe's site.
The gifts that I was given.
Okay, were they gifts? Did I give those to you?
They were gifts. No, my wife bought these.
Oh, that's right.
So it's coming out of the same pocket.
Through me. Number three, they save 20% or more of their income. That's a lot.
That's a lot, especially during this day and age. I mean, if you haven't already started that, it'd be really hard to just up and start that tomorrow. But definitely something you should be aiming to do.
So obviously the group requires an enormous amount of financial discipline. Ideally, the people who listen to the show, that's you. I mean, you're clearly interested in finance. The younger you are, this may very well be you. Most people in this group started investing and saving in their early life and continue to do so prudently for many years. Now, keep in mind, if you start in your late teens, early 20s, and you get to your mid-30s, that's 15, 20 years of saving.
Right.
And investing.
Right.
It's possible to become a millionaire in that time. The problem is social media wants you to be a millionaire like now.
Right.
I want a Lambo. Mm-hmm. None of the people in this group were people who bought a Lambo, okay?
Right.
I'm sorry.
Right. We're gonna dive into one of these paths later. I don't know what it's called in the article that Chris is going to read. We labeled it the company climber path. But mm-hmm. I think what happens to a lot of people is they begin on this path, but then they also ultimately want to start the saver's path later, thinking that once I make more money, I'll begin saving, when in order to accomplish this path, it's a long-term commitment, meaning starting early and remaining disciplined for a long time.
Yeah, so number two, the dreamer's path, the sexiest sounding one, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. The article goes on to say this is very possible, right? But it does require you to have a lot of faith and a lot of love and passion for what it is you're trying to do. Very difficult to accomplish this if you have a family. You have kids you need to be thinking of, you want to raise. I mean, mm-hmm. you could see how someone could get pulled away from this path.
But for reference purposes, the saver's path was about 22% of the millionaires reviewed for this content. Mm-hmm. Okay. The dreamer's path, 28%. So right. 6% more. So perhaps the hardest path to building wealth because it requires a pursuit of a dream, such as starting a business, becoming a successful actor, musician, or author. Approximately 28% of the folks in the study were dreamers. And they accumulated an average net worth of $7.4 million as compared to the average of $3.3 million in the saver investor path. So double, more than double.
Right.
Okay, so higher percentage, 28%, more than double the actual wealth.
Right.
That's pretty astonishing.
It is pretty astonishing. Now, I do think that this is a wide variety of people. I mean, starting a business and, let's say, somebody up and leaving and moving out to Hollywood saying, I want to become an actor, two completely different things.
Well, yes and no. It does come down to the same expertise that we've given a lot of people over time. And it comes down to that old adage, you know, you work a day doing something you hate mm-hmm. versus working a day doing something you love.
Right.
Right? And doing something you love, you never work a day in your life, right?
Yeah, that's true. No, that is very true. And the main topic of why we're bringing all this up, we will dive into later. But starting a business here, right, being an owner of a company and seeing it grow over time, it's no secret that owners of companies – you know, are well off and wealthier than the employees that they service, right? But why is that? It's because they believe in the process and they stick to what they believe in. As the company grows, your net worth grows because of the value of the company grows.
So I should point out of the four things we're going to talk about, the Dreamer's Path is by far and away the greatest wealth builder, and they actually did it in a pretty narrow period of time, on average about 12 years.
Wow.
So this is the group out of the four that makes the most amount of money, mm-hmm. accumulates the most amount of wealth. They do it in a pretty narrow period of time, but you have to be passionate. You have to be able to believe in the dream, and you have to push through a lot of the negativity and people telling you you can't or shouldn't do it. Trying to make ends meet early was not easy. At first, getting a steady paycheck was, quote, nearly impossible, one dreamer said. It was even harder for those who had families to support to finance their dreams. Some decided to put off buying a home, while others dipped into their retirement savings. If you're risk adverse, this path may not be for you.
Yeah, man. And I think given the times that we're in now, it's no secret. I think several years ago, the average age of someone buying a home for the first time was 30 years old. Mm-hmm. That's now up to 36 years old.
I know, man.
So people are having to push out, you know, their dreams of, you know, owning a home. And, you know, a lot of people don't want to start a family until they do own a home. But now that I think they're being forced, you know, to maybe change those plans.
Yeah. Shout out to Sydney Lake at Fortune, actually was quoted in an article covering a lot of those topics today in Fortune.
Oh, wow.
Where we talked about how California has the most million-dollar neighborhoods by far in the country, like over 200. And the next like four or five combined are still less than California.
Got it.
So pretty significant. The next path, the expertise-driven path, the book actually calls it the Virtuoso's Path. Mm-hmm. Roughly 19% of the participants in the study chose this path. Virtuosos are among the best at what they do in their profession. They are paid a high premium for their knowledge and expertise, which sets them apart from the competition. It took the virtuosos, however, on average about 20 years to reach an average net worth of $4 million. Some worked in the medical field, while others worked in law, right? So doctors, lawyers. A handful either worked for large publicly held corporations, and they were small business owners with highly profitable enterprises.
Right. And now this could also still kind of couple with the dreamer's path, right?
Mm-hmm.
You see like a lot of expertise. You could be someone in the automotive business and you really passionate about, you know, working on, let's say, a specific kind of car or
right.
a certain kind of build. Well, if you're that's your expertise and there's a market out there for it and you're the best, people will come and pay for the best.
I think the difference here is that an entrepreneurship defines the two of them, right? So the virtuoso path, you don't necessarily need to be an entrepreneur to make money.
Mm-hmm.
You become a subject matter expert and you're making money because you know a ton of this about this and people are going to pay you to do this.
And you have the experience, right?
Yeah. Versus a dreamer, you're building an entrepreneurship path. Like you're building a business off of your passion for this. That doesn't mean you're a subject matter expert. There's lots of people who are passionate about something that are doing it, that develop expertise over decades of doing it,
mm-hmm.
that make great money. And there's plenty of people we all know. You're like, oh, fucking Timmy from high school. He was an idiot. How is he worth millions now?
Right.
He's dreamer's path.
Yeah.
You know?
And when I was researching for this topic today, I was thinking to myself, you know, there's a guy that I know that is doing very, very well, and he's making a great living off of coaching basketball. And he's not in the NBA. He's not in college. But what does he do? He has, like, these travel club teams.
Oh,
and
yeah.
He's that good of a coach, and he teaches these kids so well that around the clock, any spare time he has, he's, you know, performing drills at the house with them. He's got club teams. Parents are willing to pay him to host the club teams. And he's traveling with these kids all around. And he's doing an amazing job, all levels. Everything from eight-year-olds all the way up to high school. And
but not a guy who made the NBA.
Not a guy that made the NBA, yeah. But he had love for this so much that he's like, I'm going to find a way to make this happen.
Let's be clear. There's lots of people in that position who wind up coaching high school and not making a ton of money.
Right. Yeah.
You know, they're passionate about it. They love it, but they don't have that same entrepreneurship drive.
Yeah, exactly.
The dreamer's path.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then the expertise-driven path. I'm sorry. Yeah, the company climber's path, I should say.
Yeah, the expertise-driven path, I think, is the virtuoso path, and then the company climber path is the last one.
So this one, near and dear to Chris's heart, this is me,
mm-hmm.
effectively. I think I'm a combination of multiple here, but you know, I'm an arrogant prick, so you never know.
I mean, we're definitely trying to do multiple.
Climbers are individuals who work for big companies and devote all of their energy, see right there, not me,
mm-hmm.
Into climbing the corporate ladder until they land a senior executive position. This is the second hardest path to becoming a millionaire. About 31% of rich people studied fell into this group. It took them an average of 22 years to accumulate a net worth of $3.4 million or more. In most cases, their wealth came from either stock compensation or a partnership share of the profits.
So stock compensation. So this brings us to what I really wanted to get into this week's teaching segment for the show, right? I know there's going to be a lot of people out there that are like, look, I'm not an entrepreneur by nature. It's going to be hard for me to start a business and be a part of that dreamer's path and really grow because that's how some of these companies start off really small and they actually turn into like some small cap companies, right? That are $300 million to $2 billion in size. And what happens there is when you're an owner of a company, right, and you're paying out your employees, you got paying the salaries, you're paying all the operating costs, the remaining profits come in and you split it amongst the owners. What do? You reinvest in the company, you continue to grow. As they continue to grow and the profits continue to grow, the valuation of the company continues to grow based on multiples, right?
Yep.
And that's something that I wanted to get into with you that I know you know a lot about because, you know, there's different multiples for different companies in different sectors.
Can you explain what multiples are?
Yeah, so I think that's perfect for Chris to dive into.
So the valuation that a company would get upon selling isn't going to be the tangible book value of the company.
Yeah.
A great way to look at this is a lot of companies trade above their book value, how much they should be worth according to, you know, what they have with us from the accounting perspective. And I'm simplifying a much broader concept. But so, for example, Apple trades at a premium of its book value. It trades at a much higher stock price. And that's how much each share is worth in the open market. That's certainly one way to look at it. And they're getting a multiple of their book value.
Right.
Right. There are Apple currently trading at $168.84, but their tangible book value is probably less than that.
Right.
It is less than that. And as you find that companies are more and more value, think NVIDIA, for example, NVIDIA is trading at a crazy multiple above where they are.
Right.
If a company is not doing well, they're going to sell at a discount to their tangible book value. Mm-hmm. I want to get a deal in buying you, so I'm going to buy you for less than you're tangibly worth.
Right.
Than you're really worth. Now, there are things that you can do when you talk about selling a company, whether private or public, where you get a multiple of selling your company. So, for example, a great way in the banking sector to look at this, as banks with a wealth advisory arm typically sell for a higher multiple than a bank alone. So somebody would pay more money for that than they would for just the bank if it were by itself. And the reason why is it's perceived to be inherently, number one, a greater source of revenue, other streams of income, and a stickier relationship to the clients who do banking and wealth advisory services with you.
Right.
So it's just a way to really say, hey, is this company worth more than their book value, than their tangible real value?
Yes.
Or are they worth less?
Yeah, exactly. And this is the thing that you always see on Shark Tank, right? When they come in and they ask you, well, what do you think your company's worth? And they value it, and they're always laughing at it, right?
Well, and there's sector and industry multiples too. So, right. So, for example, the tech sector, it might trade at a certain multiple. Mm-hmm. This is also really challenging when companies go public too, especially like in the tech sector. If you're Uber and you go public and there isn't another rideshare service around, and you're kind of democratizing a space and changing the way it works, like taxis, how do people know what your multiple should be? What do they peg you to as a recent trading similar-like company?
Yeah, we bring that up all the time on the show. Yeah. There's no other company really out there like you, right? So to break it down just a little bit further, Odun, like you said, let's say a company generates $1 million in revenue. They have operating costs of $300,000. You know, you're now left with $700,000. Let's say you have $200,000 worth of salaries you got to pay out. Let's just say we're really simplifying this, and you're left with $500,000 in profit. If you compare this said company to other companies like it and it's trading at a 5 multiple, then that means your company's valuation is $2.5 million, right?
Yeah, multiples of EBITDA, right?
Right.
Earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization.
Right.
So how much money you're making times this multiple really says what someone should pay for you. Kind of a different concept, but along the same lines.
The same lines, right? So now you look at it like, okay, based on how many owners are there, that gets divided up. What do these owners do with this $500,000 they left? Do they take it out and pay themselves a salary, or do they reinvest and grow it? Next thing you know, the following year, they're making $2 million, and now that multiple is growing.
So I know a lot of people who listen to the show are real estate investors, and they go, okay, well, how do I correlate that to what I do for a living? Okay, when you look at buying a property, you're buying a property based on the income that it can make. So if I, an investor, want to buy this piece of real estate, it can make me X amount of dollars every single month, so I'm willing to pay more or less for it because of how much money it'll make. A multiple is the same concept, right? If this business is going to make me $1 million a year, how much more am I willing to pay for it because I know it's going to make me $1 million a year versus it making me $500,000 a year?
Right, exactly. So now to get to the next step of this conversation, what I really wanted to get into is restricted stock units. So not everyone out there is going to be able to start a company like this and be one of the primary owners of the company to really help grow their net worth like you would in the dreamer's path.
RSUs, baby.
RSUs, restricted stock units. This is something that people are, offered upon like signing on, right? And sometimes there's
you
a structure.
You can get them in bonus structures. You can get them when you sign on to a company. You can get them before a company goes public. And that's a little tricky. When you get them before a company goes public, you're banking literally on the idea that it'll go public and those things will then have a value correlated to the stock price.
Right. So this is something that I think if you're young and you're upcoming, you're looking like what kind of industry to get into or what type of job you can seek. Like, this is something that you can strive to get. And so you can own a part of the company. And as time goes on, your wealth will continue to grow, right, exponentially because you do own them.
Yeah. So a great example of an industry that we all kind of know and inherently have an understanding of. the tech sector, when all these new startup companies start, they say, okay, well, if you can't afford to pay me a whole bunch of money, why would I come work for you and, you know, work these crazy ass 16-hour days? They give them RSUs. So a lot of them will get RSUs at a really low strike price. And I'll explain what that means in a minute. But let's say you go work for Robinhood pre-IPO. Mm-hmm. And Robinhood gives you, Saeed, 10,000 RSUs valued at $5 a share.
Okay.
Right? And they go public. And now their stock price is $25 a share. You can buy all those RSUs, or you have all those RSUs at a $5 strike price. So you can basically sell them at market and take the $20 per share, right?
Right.
Or in some cases, they vest and you actually have them and you have ownership of them.
That's exactly the point I was gonna say. So the key part to this is what they will do is, because they can't pay you as much upfront, like Chris said, they'll usually give you a structure, right? Mm-hmm. It's usually like a one-year cliff, I think they call it, and then four-year vesting.
Cliff vestings, it's not uncommon at all. In the banking sector, in most places that have a change of control, change of ownership agreement, it's usually a three-year type structure.
Okay.
Although I have negotiated in the past four-year versions of this. But basically, let's say you get, and this is where people get the banking compensation stuff really confused.
Okay.
Especially right now, or, you know, how are these bankers making all this money? It's because they've had years. So the way it works is, year one, I get most of my compensation in the banking business in the form of stock, right? So my base salary, and then a multiple of that I get in the form of my bonus package. But the overwhelming majority of it, as you go higher up in a company, winds up being through RSUs.
Yes.
But you don't get it all at once. You get one third of that in stock available day one. You get a third of that a year later, and you get another third of that 2 years later.
And this is a way the company can incentivize you to stay longer to make sure you don't leave, right?
Because you're not going to get those restricted. Those are restricted. You're not going to get those restricted stock units unless you're employed at the date of distribution a year later.
Right. They don't fully vest.
But when you've worked for a company for 3 years, now you've got 3 years of those vesting every single year.
Right.
And as those vest every single year, you're getting paid for it. So people are saying, well, Chris, how are these executives taking home these big-ass bonuses right now? Well, they've got 3 years prior to the last year where they were strained that they're still getting paid out on at least two, if not 3 years of that.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So that's something that I really wanted people to take note of. This is definitely an option for you, because if this is offered primarily, like we talked about, in the tech industry, in the finance industry.
New companies.
In the healthcare industry, startups all the time. I know Odun has somebody close in his inner circle that was working for Twitch back in the day that was offered a lot of, RSUs, and they fully vested and he stayed there. And Odun, I think the company, didn't Twitch get bought out by Amazon?
Amazon. Yeah, they were, Twitch got purchased by Amazon in an all cash deal for almost like $1 billion.
So is that guy buying you lunch a lot?
I mean, yeah. Why is this guy not on the show?
Yeah.
I
mean,
He used to.
Ooh, now he's rich. He doesn't want to be associated with
you. Yeah.
I left San Francisco, so.
Oh, that's right. He's in the Bay Area.
Oh, that's right. You did live in San Francisco.
Yeah. Now, he came down here last month, and he took me to Joey's for dinner.
Ooh, nice. Joey's.
In Newport.
Yes, sir.
I like Joey's. You like Joey's?
Huh?
You like Joey's?
I mean, I think it's a little overhyped. The food's good.
Food's okay, yeah.
But,
ambiance? I'm more of a Houston's guy.
It's just so Newport beachy, like over the top, you know?
I met Dwayne Wade there.
Exactly the reason why I don't want to go.
Why you don't want to go?
I saw him at Puffy's house.
That's his boy.
It is his boy. Yeah. Trust me. I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I'm in the scene, bruh.
Yeah, man.
I'm not.
No. Not anymore.
Not that scene anymore.
Yeah, not anymore. So but look.
To answer your question, sorry, Saeed. He was at Twitch, got purchased by Amazon, and he had to stay there for a few years for.
It's a retention.
Correct.
Yeah. Right.
So
you usually get a retention bonus for that, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So. Don't just look to be, try to aim to become wealthy by chasing promotions your entire career and say, I'm going to save later. I'll get to it down the road. You know, try to invest if you can. If you can actually find yourself an opportunity where you can land a job that gives you some RSUs, you're in the money. But really maybe do a self-diagnosis on whether you are in the saver's path, the dreamer's path, the virtuoso path, or the company climber path.
So I will deviate from the article a lot here. I have always believed, and frankly, the premise of much of what we advocate on the show is you can do both. Okay.
And we're doing it right now.
And we are. So again, most of your wealth is not going to be created in your 9-to-5. it's going to be greater than your 5 to 9. And that's because most people are going to be in the saver's path, the dreamer's path, right? And few of you will be in the expertise or company climber's path. I know the percentages of those who you interviewed are what they are, but for the population, the savers and the dreamers' path are probably the most two attainable.
Mm-hmm.
But you can do both of those while working a full-time job.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I had this conversation with a buddy of mine actually just the other day who was telling me, I was like, man, like I really want to start making some moves. I really dislike my, you know, 9 to 5. And I just want to be.
I know who this is.
No, no, you don't know this person. And this.
Lies.
No, I promise. And then. Because he's like, I just want to become financially free and that whole spiel, right? And I said, listen, man, I want you to know I work with some people that can very much quit their 9 to 5 because they have done enough on the side. But you don't ever give this up. You continue to do this while doing that.
I mean, if he really hates it, you know, give it up. But, I mean, you got to have a – this is the part that bothers me about people is they get so burnt out. They're like, fuck it, I don't want to do this anymore. And then they don't think about the logistics.
Yeah.
Okay, here's the truth. My 9 to 5 gives me health care.
Yeah, I mean, there's that.
You know, that's a pretty big cost when you've got a young son and a beautiful wife and, you know.
Right.
Even if I wanted to quit, there are ramifications that are, you know, that are costly. Not, and easily I could do that and run it through my companies or whatever. But there are benefits to doing both for as long as you can. If you really hate your job every single day, then look to change jobs. But don't just quit. Like, be strategic.
Yeah, be strategic, right? And try to, like, you know, shift focus, right? Don't forget what the plan, what the goal is, too. You know what I mean? I mean, clearly, this certain individual was very happy with the output and how much he was making, right? Just didn't like exactly what he was doing, you know, throughout the day.
Did you ask him the patented question, which always changes perspectives? Would you be happier if you made more money?
No, I didn't ask that question.
Most people would say, well, yeah, I mean, yeah, I'd be okay. And it's like, okay, well, then you don't hate your job. Right. You just don't feel valued by your job.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
There's a very tangible, tactile difference there.
Yeah, and there's poor management.
Could be a lot of things. I mean, it could be you don't feel like you're part of something bigger. It could be – the problem is so many people require different things from their employer to feel fulfilled.
Mm-hmm.
But not everybody communicates those things. Some people are just like type A, aggressive, like, hey, I'm going to call you when I need something. And some people are like, why hasn't my boss called me?
Yeah, see, but then you can't play victim, right?
A lot of people do that. It's just the inherent, like, people have different ways of communicating.
Yeah.
And that's the difficult part.
Yeah, and some of their, like, personal life starts to bleed into work, it really starts to affect them. I can't remember who I heard say this recently. It's like the best type of employee, the MVP employee, is the person that comes into work and is the same person every single day. You know what you're going to get out of them. They don't let anything else bleed in. And they come in, they do what they're supposed to do, and they act the same kind of way, right? It shouldn't affect you in your output.
Emotional maturity.
Yeah.
Emotional maturity is probably one of the most underrated assets, I think, of in just human population.
Right.
Emotional maturity is not something most people are born with. Almost nobody really has it out the gate. But those who do have it really have an ability to control the dynamics of a situation in a way where if you got visceral or you got angry or you respond emotionally, you lose the ability to be strategic. I'm not saying be a fucking Vulcan or something like that. I'm just saying, like, you know, if you can control your emotional response, 9 times out of 10, you're going to make a better decision.
Right. And I mean, with some of my younger cousins that sometimes they ping me for, like, advice, the number one point of conversation that we always get to is, look, you got to take responsibility for your own actions, too. This isn't, you know what I mean? This isn't just the other side. There's more to this onion that we need to peel back.
There's always more to the onion, brother, but right now we got to jump into the show.
Let's do this.
Welcome back to the number one financial literacy podcast in the world. This is The Higher Standard. Sitting next to me, my partner in time, the one and only Syed Omar, everybody.
Thank you, my man. Welcome back to the show, everybody. Sitting next to me on my left is my partner in crime, Chris Nahibi.
And behind the ones and twos, you already heard him a little bit tonight, the one and only DJ Arun.
Hello, hello.
What's up, my guy?
What's up, dude? Busy past few weeks.
It has been a busy past few weeks for him.
Yeah, so busy he's forgot the can pop a number of episodes this week.
Dude, the fridge is empty, man.
It's
the
empty.
The fridge is empty. The snacks table's empty. I haven't had time. It's my job.
Yeah, well, the snack thing, it's actually kind of good because I hear when you eat them whenever I edit.
Yeah, he's doing that strategically.
Yeah, I'm like, sorry, buddy. We're only going to have soft foods now.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Burritos only.
Cotton candy.
Cotton candy seems like a problem.
Right.
We got a huge week ahead of us. kicking off Q2 2024. There's a lot of reporting that comes out. We'll cover some of those things. But there are some remarks by Jerome Powell, which validate a lot of theories that Syed and Arun and I have had on the show that should concern you about one member of the FOMC. Mm-hmm. Non-voting, of course.
Non-voting.
We're going to get into the Kobisi letter. We now have higher for longer back, maybe, kind of. I don't know. The Fed's being a little quirky here.
Definitely feels like that's the way it should be going.
We are going to talk a little bit about inflation because the numbers did come out, and they are curious. And the Philadelphia Fed admits, finally, praise the Lord, that the U.S. payrolls have been overstated by at least 800,000 jobs.
And I did a little bit of diving here. So when we get to this segment, I'm going to explain a lot of what's going on.
And if there's time, we'll get into a couple more topics like those are from the last show, Arun, so we're not going to cover those. But yeah. We'll cover some topics around Jerome Powell's commentary and some of the things that he said and suggested if there's time. But before we get into Jerome Powell and this Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco interview that he did, let's talk about some of the reporting that comes out. You have the ISM manufacturing PMI data on Monday. Today, for references, is Tuesday, April 2nd, day after April Fool's Day. Thank God. I hate that stupid.
You hate it? Dude, my son is like all about it. He's asking me, please find a way to trick me. Like, I want to get tricked.
Oh, that's different. That's cute.
Yeah.
That's cute. I just hate all the social media stuff. Like, you see stuff and you're just like, nope, no. On April 1st, I literally go, I materially do not believe anything I see.
Yeah.
You can call me and be like, hey, man, I'm having a heart attack. And be like, yeah, okay.
Right.
I'm going to need proof.
Yeah, we need to have like a code word for like, no, I'm being serious.
Sassafras.
Sassafras.
Yeah. The JOLTS job openings report came out today. The OPEC meeting is on Wednesday. Hear about oil prices. February jobs report on Friday. That would be a big one. Hopefully it won't have as much of a discrepancy as we've seen historically. And then the total of 14 Fed speaker events this week. 14.
I know exactly what this is.
But Fed Chair Powell speaks Wednesday.
Uh-oh. That sounds like a segue.
Does sound like a segue. He already spoke, and I think, frankly, he should hang it up.
Honestly, he did a little drop the mic.
We have long believed that Neel Kashkar, a non-voting member of the FOMC, was built different. And by built different, we meant that they had a special table for him in the room with which they gave him crayons to draw his special dot plot. And that we thought, you know, nobody really takes him that seriously. I like Neel. Seems like a stand-up guy, but he's different.
That's disingenuous. You don't like Neel?
I don't like Neel. And, you know, up until recently, this was just conjecture theory. But let us not forget that Syed Omar is a Nobel laureate to be.
I mean, they need to kick his ass out. That's got to be my seat.
That's got to be your gig.
That's got to be my next gig.
It pays a lot of fucking money.
I'm more relatable to everyone out there. Why don't
you? Got more hair.
I know.
I mean, if that were a measuring stick.
It's got to be.
Yeah. Well, shall we just let Jerome Powell speak for himself?
Yeah, let's do this.
Arun, if you could.
Back to Kashkari for a minute and the interview I did with him. Well, explain that.
What?
A little chuckle.
You said back to Kashkari.
Well, you know, Neel's an interesting guy.
You said back to Kashkari. It's the motherfucking
Eagle Double G. Snoop Dogg. Bro, if that wasn't some shade.
If Jerome Powell, the head.
Right.
The tip, if you will.
The honorable.
Is out there throwing grenades at you, brother.
It's not looking good for you long term.
You should probably think about career choices now.
Yeah, that's it. What was that? What do you think he, why does he dislike him so much?
I don't think he dislikes him intentionally. Mm-hmm. I just think he, you know, he's like, look. No.
No. Kashkari, you know what? He comes off as one of those guys that's like acting like he's trying to be part of the crew, and everyone at the crew is looking at him like, dude, you just got here.
Kashkari is just kind of a nerdy, goofy guy, and he has like this weird way of kind of deviating from the consensus opinion. Mm-hmm. And look, he's the head of one of the districts, you know? I mean, yeah. He's not not respected. I mean, he's just.
I mean, they don't just give that job to anybody. Obviously, he's definitely.
Maybe they do though.
No,
I mean, clearly Jerome Powell doesn't think he should have it.
Yeah, yeah, he's advocating for somebody else.
Yeah, shots fired. So now that the fun's out of the way, and Jerome Powell said all the important things he needs to say for this this time, let's get in to some information from the Kabusi letter as it relates to inflation.
Mm-hmm.
We now have a couple things for you to consider. CPI, inflation is up 2 straight months, first time since September of 2023. PPI inflation nearly doubled year over year, highest since October of 23. PCE inflation up in February, first time since August of 2023. 3M annualized supercore, highest since June of 2023. I'm going somewhere with this. Stick with me. Mm-hmm. 6M. 3 months, 6 months, by the way. Annualized core CPI, highest since July of 2023. 3 month annualized core CPI, highest since May of 2023. And 6 month annualized services CPI, highest since February 2023.
I think what everybody needs to take from this is that that's a lot of data there. It's basically what this means is the economic data that the Fed is analyzing on whether they should be cutting or keeping the rates higher for longer is coming in stronger than what they would like to see. That's a lot of data.
But in the two conversations that Jerome Powell has had since the inflation print, he has said not once, not twice, but now thrice, that as long as inflation continues down the path that they expect it to go, and this was part of that path,
mm-hmm,
they fully expect to continue to have rate cuts this year.
So I really gave this some thought over the last week, especially after what Jerome Powell said and reading the Kobisi letter. There has to be a palpable fear of stagflation around the corner. That's the only thing. Why would you still cut? So if we talk about it routinely on the show, the jobs numbers are reporting to be very, very well. Unemployment is very, very low. We're having economic growth. The stock market, even though we took a dip the last 2 days, still all-time highs, right? There's nothing really signaling, even though we know there should, other than, you know, the inverted yield curve and some of these, but we see the underlying data. We're reading the fine print.
Mm-hmm.
The big headline figure numbers are all signaling that there's no need for a rate cut right now, right? So there has to be, in my mind, a palpable fear of stagflation being around the corner.
And for those of you who don't follow, there's a great chart on the interwebs basically showing you that stagflation is essentially a recession.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it is. That's when you have like slow economic growth, meaning we're not actually growing at all. We're contracting, mm-hmm, right? There's higher unemployment and there's high inflation at the same time while demand is decreasing, right?
Correct.
So meaning, and we're headed that way. Right? How could that happen? Is even when they cut rates, right? That means we can see that right now. People can only live off credit cards for so long, man. Okay?
We've been saying that for a long time, man. $1.13 trillion in credit card debt does not a happy camper Chris make.
So exactly. So once this comes to an end and people can no longer afford to live and inflation is still going up, that's what causes the demand to go down. And I know we're getting really technical here, but in that kind of environment, that's when all hell breaks loose.
Well, hold that thought. Let's continue on with inflation, the Kobisi letter, the next article, Arun, if you don't mind. So continuing on for inflation. What are you doing there, buddy? Okay, there we go. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. February PCE inflation, the Fed's preferred inflation measure, rises to 2.5% in line with expectations of 2.5%. So again, kind of echoing what Jerome Powell said, as long as it continues to go the way we think it's going to go, and we did think it was going to go this way,
mm-hmm,
we still see rate cuts in the year. So it did increase slightly.
Okay.
Core PCE inflation was 2.8%, in line with expectations of 2.8%. We now officially have rising CPI, PPI, and PCE, all the inflation metrics, for those of you who need to know that. So let me put the question back on you.
Okay.
If the Fed has done all that they have over the course of the last 2 years.
Yes.
And they're saying we still expect rate cuts at the end of the year if all things stay as we plan them to be. And they're saying here, we did expect this to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't sound like they're worried about it.
No, I feel like they're trying to downplay it. Look, they are worried about it. What he's using to get out of this right now is he thinks there's some seasonality at play here. Okay?
I agree.
And so, historically speaking, we knew this print from PCE was going to come in because the CPI figure and the PPI figure really signal this. Okay? Here's the thing, though. The next CPI report that comes out, there's no seasonality that could be tied to it. And these figures, we've talked about it routinely on the show. They're not going to go down unless real estate comes down, right? The shelter component comes down, right? That's not coming down. So they have a real...
Actually, it kind of is.
You think so?
No, I know so. So there's some interesting data coming out now. I mean, it's early data, so it's not official. But you've seen the new housing numbers for the average new housing builds.
Well, new housing has come down, but existing median sale prices are up 6%.
I saw some recent stuff come out now.
Okay.
Which revised a lot of that down.
So data is being now reported and coming in?
Yeah. I saw it parsed down pretty
quickly. Well, I hope so, because all eyes right now are really focused in on this upcoming Friday. So by the time this episode comes out, the jobs report this Friday will come out for February.
So I couldn't validate that data. It was Reventure, I think it was the data supplier. And I couldn't really. The problem was the guy who reposted it is known for kind of spinning data his way. Mm. So I couldn't validate it enough to use it in the show notes, but it certainly looked like the trajectory is going down. But it also looked like it was very, very dependent on what region you were in.
Okay.
So certain areas like Southern California, for example, still very much on the rise.
Right.
But there was definitely something up with the data. And something else I would point out, too, we are seeing his article was originally pitched with the ideology that we're seeing the drop in existing home sales prices drop at a cadence last seen only in 2008, which was a housing recession.
Right.
I think that's a bit much, frankly.
Okay.
So I didn't want to put it in the show and cite it because I didn't feel like I could validate the data yet.
Got it. Makes sense. But like we mentioned, so you talked about manufacturing that came out earlier this week. That's hit a 22-month high. Okay. Think about it. How are these things hitting all-time highs when the Fed's trying to do the exact opposite? Right? Mm-hmm. And if these things are hitting all-time highs, that's not signaling we need a rate cut. So the fact that he's sticking to his guns, like, no, we're still going to rate cut, he realizes, like, man, the plan has not worked out.
So to that point, we're going to cover an article at the end of this. So the reason why I laid the show out like this was I wanted to get into all the data that's come out and get into how perplexing some of these, like, the direction is.
Okay.
The next one, we'll talk about payrolls for a little bit, and it's going to certainly throw a little bit of a wrench in this. And then we're going to talk about some interesting data as it relates to corporate profits. And Arun, I was wrong. You're right. That it was part of this show. I just don't remember what I put in the show like a week ago because I'm an idiot. But the Philadelphia Fed admits that U.S. payrolls were overstated by at least 800,000. This is from Zero Hedge. Now, Zero Hedge has been on the forefront of calling shenanigans on the jobs reports for quite a long period of time. And I will admit, when Zero Hedge first started putting these articles out, I was like, they're just being kind of extremist. I don't know. But they were so good at breaking this down in the last show, episode 223, that we talked about it and we kind of went over some of the data, the high points. We talked about it a little bit on episode 222, I believe. But the first red flags emerged in the summer of 2022. That's when the Biden Labor Department started well and truly rigging the labor market data. Mm-hmm. I don't like this because that's somewhat accusatory. It's the Biden Labor Department, and there's some problems that I have with the sentiment here. But essentially, regular readers may recall that it was back in July of 2022 when Zero Hedge first warned that something had, quote, snapped, end quote, in the labor market. That's when a striking discrepancy emerged between the number of U.S. payrolls as measured by the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics Establishment Survey, a far more crude and imprecise yet much more market-moving data series, and the number of actual employed workers as measured by the BLS's far more accurate household survey. As Zero Hedge showed, then after the two series had tracked each other tick for tick for years, a wide gap opened up in March of 2022, which quickly grew to 1.5 million jobs in just about 3 months. My theory here is that I don't believe there's a political conspiracy. I don't believe the Biden department is intentionally doing this. Do I think they sent out a memo in June of 2022
right,
saying that we weren't in a recessionary economy? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I do. I believe they did that.
Mm-hmm.
I believe they tried to change the narrative. Do I think they're changing the number with BLS? Well, no, because there's lots of other numbers from other government agencies that come out that don't support them.
Right. So let's backtrack just a little bit here. So let's remember that there are a few headline data, economic data points that analysts like to look at when they're examining the health of the economy, right? And especially during this time with what the Fed wants to do. We can run down those. We got CPI, mm-hmm. we got PPI, we got the jobs report, right? Which includes the unemployment rate, right? Mm-hmm. So, and PCE. Really, you got, boiling it down, you got inflation reports and jobs reports, right?
Yes, sir.
So when you're analyzing those figures and the conspiracy theories of, is, you know, the Biden administration rigging the jobs numbers because they're being reported out to be stronger than expected, right? Something to keep in mind, when the jobs report comes out, one of the things that also comes out is revisions of the last 2 months,
mm-hmm.
every single time. So every time one comes out, they're also providing updated data on the previous 2 months. And when what it's not spoken about enough is the jobs numbers being reported is an estimation
yep.
of what's going on. It's not fact. So in last year, actually, it was, I think it's the only year where every month except for the month of October was revised down.
Yeah.
Every single month except for the month of October was revised down.
It's wild how inaccurate this shit is, and yet it moves markets, man.
And look, people buy into it. Like, oh, the economy must be very healthy.
Like, oh, fuck, it's bad news, sell, sell, sell. Or like, you know.
Right.
And you can look at the banking sector. I mean, obviously, I track that closely. And CPI comes out good. Regional bank stocks.
Yeah.
They go up that day.
Right.
CPI trades, you know, the wrong way, and stocks go the other way. I mean, it's just, it's astonishing to me to see how volatile the markets are.
Right.
But you can, I mean, going back to, you know, the market manipulation and kind of the substance that you see is, if you had some of this information early, if you were like, you know, I don't know, if you were somebody named Nancy Pelosi,
mm-hmm.
and you had access to this information early, you know this is a guaranteed bet.
Right.
I'll use the banking sector as a great way. If you knew the inflation numbers going to come out because you're, you know, your access to privy to information,
right.
and your husband miraculously finds that out and trades based on that, he knows what the inflation numbers going to come out, you could just short the banking stocks, or you could just, you know, I mean,
yeah,
this you is game the system.
Yeah, or they know that of some company having a wild contract, right?
You know, for chip making.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. maybe, right? I mean, I would equate this to when you're looking at these, you know, big economic data points and you're trying to assess for yourself, like, well, how can I read this? What do I make of this, all this information, right? Is this is no, you got to read the fine print. You got to try to understand what's really going on here. Mm-hmm. So this is, I just thought about this right now while we're talking. It's like getting a bag of almonds, right? And the almonds say 150 calories. Oh, this is healthy. But it's got four servings in there. So you're just gonna crush 600 calories.
Amen.
Right? It's like, wait, I thought it was healthy, but you're not reading the fine print that there's four servings in that bitch. Is it a little too vulgar with the bitch?
No, I think that's appropriate. I feel like you were
attacking almonds?
No, taking a shot at my weight.
Why? No. Almonds. People think almonds are healthy, bro. They're super fatty.
Well, yeah, they're nuts.
Yeah. But a lot of people think, oh, that's a healthy snack. So they just go buy a bag of almonds and they'll just crush them.
So you don't love nuts?
Ain't no party like a Diddy party.
There's nuts everywhere in that house. There's macadamia nuts. There's cocoa nuts. There's walnuts.
I couldn't leave it alone. It was right there. It was hanging right there.
Ain't no cashews in that house, though.
Them nuts were hanging.
Yeah. Toffee nuts.
Yeah, exactly.
Rue, what's your favorite kind of nut?
Yeah, what is
chocolate covered nuts.
Well done. Golf clap.
Hell yeah.
Good job, sir.
Shut the fuck up.
My only contribution to the show.
I loved it.
That's going to be a YouTube clip.
Yeah.
Here's a bag of chocolate covered nuts for Rune.
Yeah.
Well, the next article comes from Yahoo Finance, and corporate profits reach new highs. That's right. I know what you're thinking. What in the actual fuck, Chris? Well, yeah, Companies are making more money than ever. They used the opportunity to right-size the ship and raise product prices, and while things seem to have leveled off for their costs, they have not reduced their prices, leading to, in one of many examples, of them making more money. New government data shows corporate profits rose to an all-time high at the end of 2023, providing new ammunition for Democrats who want to refocus voter anger about price increase towards Wall Street. You will be hearing more about this between now and November 5th of this year when the election occurs. Mm. The broadest measure released Thursday by the Commerce Department found corporate profits rose $133.5 billion in the fourth quarter to an annualized rate of more than $3.4 trillion for the first time ever.
God damn, man. This isn't just some like accounting trick.
No, this is real money.
Yeah.
Cash was everything around me. Dollar bills, y'all.
Oh, so disappointed. You fumbled that?
I was thinking I was going to go Diddy song, and then I'm like, we've hit Diddy too hard.
Yeah, we've gone too bad.
Yeah, I got to back off. I'm like, Chris, no more Diddy jokes.
Yeah.
And then one fell out.
Yeah.
President Joe Biden and his Democratic allies did not hesitate to link the new numbers to corporate profiteering. Is that a word?
They're so unsexy with their vernacular.
They were profiteering.
I feel like this is our market. Like, they should be hiring us as consultants to make it sexy.
As they try to make the subject into a top-tier campaign issue. What does a higher standard think about this, Chris? I don't like profiteering.
Yeah.
I like calling diddying the profits.
Diddying the, that's so good.
Yeah.
Right?
We're going to appeal to the younger generation with something that they fully understand means getting fucked. Okay? So what we're doing here, America, is we're diddying the profits.
Yeah, there you go.
Or if you want to be
puffing.
More. Yeah, hip.
Yeah.
We're P diddying. Puff daddying.
I mean, yeah, you can find a way.
We're puffing.
This is our call. This is our call to fame right here. We should be consultants for these companies.
Within hours of Thursday's release, Biden's top economic advisor, not Neil Kashkari, Lael Brainard? If you got a name like Lael, just go with L.
Right.
You know? Or change it.
Way cooler, too. Yeah, I mean, Big L.
Yeah, Big L.
Gangster name.
It also means big loss. Yeah. Ooh, yeah. We kind of ruined our own reputation with that one.
Big L. Dude, that's a rapper name.
Okay, well, Big L promised that with corporate profits still elevated, President Biden would continue to call on companies to pass their savings on to the consumer. What fucking world are you living in, Lael? Where you think, hey, corporations that are in a profit business for shareholder value, hey, do me a favor. You know all the extra money you're making? I need you to give that back to the consumers.
And how do you plan on doing that, Lael?
Lower your prices, guy. You're making too much.
Yeah, yeah.
Lower your prices.
Oh, so.
Hey, Lael.
So go into a deflationary economy.
Why don't you go to the fucking Pentagon and tell me where that missing billions of dollars are?
A lot of billions. Yeah, a lot of millions. Jeez.
Fucking Lael.
Right.
Oh, Jesus Christ. It's a female. Who would have guessed?
We didn't know.
Okay, Arun, while we're here, can you just ping me on country of origin for the name Lael?
Yeah, country of origin, Lael.
It's got to be Germany, right?
Wait, pass. How are you going to pass that on? What are you smoking?
It's just wild. It just. I mean that's Hebrew. Appealing, huh?
Hebrew.
Oh, okay. All right. I mean,
I'm not touching that.
Yeah, I mean,
leave me alone. Leave me out of this.
Regional origin. Leave the politics outside of it, okay? Profit margins in 2023 are down slightly from their post-pandemic peak, but they have spent recent years at persistently high levels not seen since an economic boom that followed World War II. This is not a good article for us. Yeah. In the fourth quarter, non-financial profit margins did jump to end the year to a rate of 15.12%.
Hey, that's divine intervention right there.
Yeah, Jesus.
Come on, man.
All right. So there are two charts here I do want to share, which I think really manifest the visual for you. If you're driving, don't worry. We'll articulate it in a way that makes you feel like you're seeing the show physically. Mm-hmm. So right now, we are looking at a corporate profits reach new highs chart showing U.S. corporate profits after tax from 2009 to 2023. Suffice it to say, they were just a hair over $1 trillion in Q1 of 2009. By Q4 of 2023, they're well over $3 trillion, approaching the halfway point of $4 trillion. So that's a 3X, kids.
Yeah.
Three times as much money.
Not good enough for
Grant. It is a no wonder the stock price in the market is up. If you can go to the next image, Arun, I would appreciate that greatly. There's profit margins hovering at historic highs. This going a little farther back, corporate profit margins since the COVID-19 pandemic have been at levels not seen since the boom that followed World War II, as we mentioned earlier, going all the way back to World War II through all the recessionary economies. And if you're looking at this chart and you're actually on YouTube where you should be, you'll see there's lots of gray bars going up and down that seem to be at an irregular cadence. Those are recessionary economies.
Yeah.
The wider the bar, the longer, more prolonged the recessionary economy. And you can see how consistent they were over time. What I'd like to point out is if you look at this chart, one thing becomes very evident. Recessionary economies happened at a much more frequent cadence with the exception of, I want to say, 1960 to 1970s.
Mm.
They happened a lot more regularly, historically, particularly from the 1950s and 1960s. 1960, 1970s, pretty big gap. 1970, 1980s, significant recessionary economies. Yeah. 1980s, 2000, pretty wide gap. 2010 recession, now at arguably our widest gap ever.
And right, and something to also take note, that's what made the economy healthy. You need those corrections.
You do need those corrections.
Because if you don't, then you get an overcorrection.
Overcook, undercook.
Yeah, have to.
I had to do it.
Every time.
Fred Armisen, what a genius.
Gangster.
So it's clear that you're looking at a situation where you have companies benefiting from strategic moves they made during what we perceive to be a recessionary economy. So inflation going slightly back up, but down from where it was. Yet here we are in a situation where companies are making more money than ever. Mm-hmm. The S&P 500 is trading at near and at all-time highs. You've got a lot of things that outwardly show wealth and success.
Right.
And I'm going to come down to a very strange question.
Okay.
For both you and Arun. I listened to a Joe Rogan episode on morality and kind of the interactions of humans from a sociological perspective that I think was fascinating. Went down a rabbit hole. And have we lost all morality in how we do things as a population?
Mm.
And I'll point out to a great example. You guys are familiar with the colossal clusterfuck that is the AI rollout by Google.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Where somebody clearly programmed this thing to be culturally diverse in all representations of people through history. So I think one of the questions was, you know, to generate an image from Nazi Germany, since we covered that topic earlier tonight, and it included African-Americans in the picture.
Okay.
So clearly they tried to take woke culture ideals and program it into...
to be all-inclusive.
All-inclusive system. And it's a great example of a macro problem that is not racially motivated. It's just a sociological construct that's problematic now.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, a person alone is intelligent. But a group of people can be intimidating to stop intelligence from rising, and groupthink can make very intelligent people do very stupid shit.
Well, this is the number one topic of conversation across universities across the nation right now.
Yes, it is.
Right?
Yes,
it's,
it is.
It's literally keeping people from, you know, thinking outside the box because they're too afraid to speak openly and freely about a topic that they're unsure about or uncertain about.
You don't want to be a radical on the left or the right.
Well, even if, like, they'll, like, crucify you if you don't know about a topic and you're genuinely curious.
Yeah, oh, yeah, 100%.
Right? And it's like, okay, this should be a free setting or open setting where I could speak freely.
No, there isn't that anymore.
And be like, just curious. No. Right?
I mean, look what cancel culture did to so many careers. Although, Andrew Schultz, God bless his fucking heart, that man can say anything and not get canceled.
Well, that's the beauty behind comedy, right?
Not all comics get that way. Come on, man.
No, not all comics get that way. But, I mean, he did his part for comedy and he was really protecting, you know, the freedom of speech. I mean, comedians go back and, you know, and that's what, like, they really fight for. They're usually the ones.
I think Dave Chappelle can do it. I think Andrew Schultz could do it. I think Eddie Murphy's afraid of getting canceled, but probably could do it.
Mm-hmm.
But
Well, you got to also, like, yes, because there's enough people there back in the showing that, look, there's still an audience out here that appreciates this,
yeah,
right? And it's look, it's inclusive, right? That's one thing that I believe Schultz said that I really admired a lot. Is like, okay, if you're going to get upset at me for attacking a certain group, understand I'm attacking all the groups. So I'm including you. Yeah. It's more inclusive. Whereas if I treat you special, I'm like, oh, I can't talk about this group, right? It makes complete sense to me.
No, it does. It's just, you know, there's always somebody who's going to try to cancel somebody because they just fall into the spectrum. But back to the corporate profit thing, you know, have companies, are companies now victim to groupthink that, look, like, profitability is the sole driver, morality is not a concern for us?
Well, here's the problem for them, and this is, I think, really a question back for you, right? You're an executive at a publicly traded company.
Mm-hmm.
You have a fiduciary responsibility to the shareholder.
Yep, 100% we do.
Right? So you got to do what's in the best interest of the shareholder. So although you would like to be a little bit more, have a little bit more morality, as you would like to call it, right? Even though I don't really think there's a whole lot of morality in here in place, because if you don't do what's in the best interest of the shareholder, next thing you know, you look the other way, your stock price is trading down, you're no longer trading at tangible book value, and it's game over.
So I believed in morality, and then I saw how even that could get twisted. Not morality in general. I believe be moral. I'm saying, like,
no,
in the corporate world.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, no, it's different.
So ESG, environmental social governance, which is, in my mind, has been completely bastardized. To me, it's tantamount to Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
Right? The idea was holding corporations accountable for literally environmental, social issues.
Yeah.
Right? That could impact civilization, that we as a humanity should have some concern about. And I remember the CEO of Cantilever, maybe he was chairman of the board, Paul something, he gave this amazing presentation in New York. I've talked about it on the show before. All about ESG. And when you go through a proxy fight, one of the first things they look at is ESG, right? Before Glass Lewis or the major proxy contest companies, which Disney is going through right now, render their opinion. Like, that's the first section of their opinion is ESG.
Wow.
Which is really compelling, given that what that really means from a macro perspective about shareholders and who represents them. But then you look at companies like Exxon.
Okay.
And they have an incredibly high ESG score.
Interesting.
An oil and gas company, really?
Yeah.
And you start thinking about other companies that are similar to this, and you think to yourself, like, okay, what? How do you say that company is okay, but then other companies aren't? And then you look at, like, EVs, right? An EV is supposed to be better for the environment, but there's lithium from mines.
Yeah.
That essentially came from slavery in those batteries.
I know. A lot of people dying over those batteries.
And you can't say that it was farmed ethically. No, they don't exist ethically.
Exactly. You just aren't hearing about it.
Right. But yet EVs are looked at as good for the environment, right? Mm-hmm. Are they? I mean, I drive a Rivian, don't get me wrong, like, cool car, like, whatever, like, you know. I'm just saying, like, we've gotten to this point where, at what point does a fiduciary duty become more damaging to society in this hypothetical manifested thing that we created as a responsibility that doesn't technically exist? A corporation is not a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a human. It doesn't have feelings. Yet we are doing things in a way that puts this thing
mm-hmm.
on a pedestal, and we treat it better than we treat humanity.
Yeah, it's sad.
I mean, it has an inflection point, right?
Yeah.
At what point does the company become that company from every, you know, dystopian future film you've ever seen that right. runs everything?
Yeah, exactly. That's the problem, right, with these big corporations. That's the fear of big corporations taking over, right?
They already have, man.
Yeah.
Look at Apple. Look at Microsoft. Look at GE. All these companies are breaking. The companies we grew up with
mm-hmm.
are now being broken up for antitrust concerns. They control too much of the market.
A monopoly, right?
Yeah, bro. How many decades have these companies controlled too much of the market?
Yeah, exactly.
How much cash does Apple have to have on hand before you're like, oh, they're clearly bullying companies?
or how much cash do they have to have on hand where they could literally, you know, sway an election?
Oh, and they all try. They all try. And that's the crazy part about the billionaires that we have now that have such... It's one thing to be a billionaire and be quiet. It's another thing to be a billionaire and have a platform. And when you have a platform, especially with your access to funds, the amount of messaging you can get out there can really change a narrative. And when you go back and look historically at presidents, I challenge anyone to listen to the show, go back and look at it. Billionaires have contributed to presidential elections for all the time.
Yeah.
They have helped define and choose the path of who would ultimately be president.
Mm-hmm.
That's a scary thing when you think about it. They it are is. Not a representative person for the population, but they are making decisions for the population.
My favorite quotes of all time, a wise man once said, only thing worse than a coward is a coward with power.
Oh, I thought you were going to talk about Diddy again.
It was Jadakiss.
Was it Jadakiss?
It was Jadakiss.
Oh. Whatever happened to him?
What do you mean? Still around.
Is he?
Yeah. Let's get into this review. Okay. That was a good conversation. Odin, you got anything to throw into that?
No, you guys hit it.
All right. Let's see here. Review time, baby. All right. Best podcast ever. This from our boy, Vic Ramirez.
Mm. A man has been a man of his word.
Honestly?
Dating a new girl now, so we hope to see her in her large family's reviews as well, but this is a very great start.
Honestly, she chose well.
She chose well. I mean, yeah. Vic is obviously a stud.
Stud. 5 stars. Chris Saeed and DJ Orun.
All spelled accurate.
I know. He knows what he's doing.
Yeah, he knows.
Are amazing hosts with deep and insightful knowledge ranging across many sectors of finance. Well, thank you, Vic.
Mm-hmm.
My guys are always keeping it real with the latest updates on the economy and much more. If you're looking for a podcast with diverse topics in financial literacy, look no further than The Higher Standard. Squad up.
And clap them cheeks.
Clap them cheeks. Yacht it up. And if you're listening to this podcast on Apple or Spotify, please head over and leave us an honest 5-star review. This means a lot to the show. I'll be honest, we hadn't got one in a while. When we got this one, we all got really excited. If you're watching this over on YouTube like you should be, make sure you subscribe, ring that notification bell. Make sure you smash that like button. Let's get this out to as many people as possible.
We do get a lot of reviews on other channels, though.
Yeah. But do the moist, goody-good sassafras.
I was really excited you stopped doing that.
I didn't stop. Can't stop, won't stop. Another Diddy reference.
There's a lot. There's a lot.
I have to.
I mean, no one's going to take him seriously anymore, right?
Can't.
I mean, I don't be that guy.
What's going to happen to him? You think he's going to get off free?
Dude, they're subpoenaing records from corporations that he worked with. Like, whatever they're going for, it's...
You think they're going for a bigger fish?
No. I think his career is done.
Well, his career is done.
Yeah.
But I'm saying, is he going to be put away? What's the over-under?
I don't know that... I mean, Epstein took a long time to happen, too, right? And they tried to get him once. They failed. They got him a second time.
Yeah. It's scary how much of a resemblance there is here to the storylines.
There's a lot of similarities, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's disgusting. But, you know, I don't know enough about... First of all, the number of cameras in his house was questionable.
They're, like, really small, right?
Yeah, they're really small. There was, like, 100 and something of them around his house.
I mean, yeah, that's past the point of paranoia, and that's, like, you're trying to get some blackmail.
But I'm sure he had, like, 100 rooms. That was a big-ass fucking house.
Well, that's his thing, right? He's throwing these parties. He sees what's going on. And then, like, who's he... He's not watching the film on this. He's got a whole team watching this and letting him know, like, what's the deal? You know what I mean?
You would think someone would talk, though.
No, man. If you want to make it in the industry, they're on the payroll, bro.
At what point is he not able to get somebody to make it in the industry anymore and people start talking?
No, they could. If they want you to make it, you make it. Russ was on Flagrant, and he talked about this. They're literally buying the streaming numbers.
Oh, yeah. It's true. We should really do that.
I know. Honestly, the fact that we haven't done that, people need to like respect it a little bit more. We could have easily done that.
There's so many bullshit at, like that Yala chick who's got a podcast in the financial space.
Hala Yala or something?
Yeah. Fuck, her whole shit is fake. Fake reviews, fake everything. There's the other guy. There was a guy in Vegas, the nerdy looking dude who does. I mean, he looks like a fucking joke.
What guy in Vegas?
You know what I'm talking about? The kid with the curly hair and the glasses. That had that 11 million followers on fucking...
Oh, I vaguely remember this.
On Instagram. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Name's escaping me right
now. Yeah, fuck him. Whatever. It doesn't matter. We shouldn't say his name anyway.
Yeah.
But that guy, literally, fake reviews, fake followers on Instagram, fake everything, charging people $6,000-$7,000 for appearance fees, using the studio at the MGM Grand.
Oh, yeah, no. That's kind of sick. One day we got to be able to do that.
I mean, it's cool. We could probably do that now if we really wanted
to. I'm saying we got to do that. You know what we should do? We should go out to Summer League next year, and we should check out Summer League.
You just follow around athletes and be like, hey, man, I know you don't listen to our show or nothing, but I'd like to talk to you on a mic.
Yeah. That's the thing. Maybe that's what we do.
I only charge you $6,000 to do it.
We scope out the talent early, get them on the show, and be like, don't forget who gave you your first look.
Yo, Victor. Victor, we got an extra big seat for you. Sit down.
Right?
You know?
That's what I'm saying.
Arun laughed at that. Yap with Hala Taha.
Unsubscribe. Unsubscribe right now.
If you're subscribed to this, I'm going to kill you.
Honestly, unsubscribe to our podcast.
Yeah, her whole podcast, all of her numbers have been proven to be bullshit before. And yet, here's the thing that pisses me off about this podcast, the other one I was just talking about, is that you get legitimate, over time, regardless how fake you are, the numbers look big enough, people go on the shows.
And the production value looks legitimate, too.
Yeah, and I mean, look, that's, I mean, I'll give them that. The production value is real. I mean, it's good.
Yeah.
But I'm just like, come on, man.
I'm seeing what you're doing with our production value.
What do you mean?
It's looking good. The one you did. The cover. On the last episode. 222, I think.
223.
223.
Yeah,
came out nice.
I'm going to do some more. There's some stuff. I'm trying to find a way to make a process as seamless as possible because I don't have a lot of time to do it.
Yeah.
But I'm getting there. I'm getting there.
Cool. And we got some stuff we're going to release next week, I believe.
What we teased.
Yeah, the video.
Yeah.
Special video. We're going to try to release that next week. Odin, you got anything?
No, I'm just checking out this chick's page.
Stop right there.
I was checking out this chick's.
Yeah, let's leave that on the show for you to. we'll cut that off.
Check out this chick's. My wife listens now, too. So.
And she listens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's going to be an awkward conversation. You say you're checking out this chick's what? And then Chris bleeped you out?
Yeah. Silence it. It's a dead drop.
I'm just gonna go right in the Diddy song.
We ain't nowhere. I love that song. All right, you got anything?
No, definitely not anymore.
Not after that. All right. Good night, everybody.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.